Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mean Team.
QNL.
With guest co-hosts.
Next Soldier.
Troy Goodfellow.
Let's go to the guest co-host who has the least seniority, which would be you, Troy.
Oh, God. What do you want to do?
No pressure.
I did not expect this great honor.
One-handed E-push-ups. Go, 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 go. First off, the fact that you think this is an honor will make this easier. Would you like to do the introduction to the show?
Sure. I am Troy Goodfellow, and you are listening to episode 95 of the Polycast. I'm very thrilled to be back on the number one Civ community podcast on the internet. With me today is Daniel Quick.
We're only 5 episodes from 100. Be very, very afraid.
John Ryder.
Glad to be here again.
Mackie.
I'm going to go start hiding now before we get to episode 100.
Lisa Bang.
Caffeine-free for the first time.
Caffeine-free? Good God, why?
I'm moving, and I have no coffee with me right now.
Well, you have our sympathies.
And finally, Philip Bellew.
Using and abusing the AI for a lot more than just City Garrison.
Do we need to be looking for your name in the news? Is that telling us?
Oh, I don't think you need to look for it.
In the Senate, worst unique building followed by settling in place in Civilization 4, and then in forum talk, zero-day downloadable content for Civilization 5.
Welcome to the Senate, where we discuss game strategy.
There's a poll on Civ Fanatics about which unique buildings are the most useless, and that's probably hard to decide. Personally, I'm a big not a fan of the Mall myself. I don't think I have ever built a Mall in my entire Civ career, Civ 4.
I would say that any unique building that is only going to come about in the later game
is probably not getting built.
Yeah, unless you're one of those advanced starts people, and as I've said before, you know, I try to pretend you guys don't exist. Sorry, nothing personal. right now in this poll of 164 votes, 39 people have voted for the Dunn, the Celt unique building, which is the wall replacement. And what the heck does it give you that's so impressive? Oh, the free Guerrilla One promotion for land units.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome, yeah.
Archery units and gunpowder, specifically.
You're not even supposed to build walls in the first place. Like, a few episodes back, we had this topic called Never Build Walls, Never Build Barracks, right? And I think the consensus was, you know, just don't build walls. Well, no, I think somebody said do it, but...
Come on, don't reference jokes, right?
But still, we discussed it, like, semi-seriously.
I guess.
Anyway, the Dunn sucks. This poll was pretty spot on.
Well, the Dunn, it's a little hard to use to its potential, so I can see why it was favored in the poll, although I don't think it's quite the worst unique building. I do agree that it's definitely down there. You do have some modifications for it that can be really annoying, like Guerrilla 3 on longbows, that you can actually camp them in enemy territory for choking and then actually threaten cities. Or later on, you can get Guerrilla 3 on muskets or even grenadiers. So, as part of a mixed stack, you can actually see some use for it, especially in the hillier maps. I would compare it with the Forum. The Forum's really underwhelming, too. Everything else about Rome is so godly that you kind of forget that the unique building isn't so hot. 25% great person points. Which, in most cities where you're not going to be running a lot of specialists for that will actually generate great people, is basically a null effect. Not to mention that markets really aren't a great build in a lot of early cities anyway. It makes it weak. I mean, it's a minor boost to your great person farm, but you're only going to get, like, your great people a couple turns sooner that way. I mean, it's harder to generate a whole lot more than 20, 30 GPP early on at base. So even in an ideal scenario, that things like worth 4 great person points after you manage to build it. Is it worse than Dunn? I don't know, but it's not a good early unique building.
It's not worse than Dunn. You will have great people farms, so that production might end up mattering in cases in pretty much every map. The Dunn sucks.
probably the two for me that really are the biggest woofers, like just awful, are the assembly plant and the Fatoria. And I don't know which to say is worse, because those two are really bad. The Fatoria puts a boost on the tiles you want to work last in cities that really aren't your greatest cities to begin with, and it comes later, too, so it's not like you can get this like weak bonus early. And then the assembly plant, if you don't have coal, it basically just gives you engineer slots when they're later in the game, and they really don't matter as much. You might be able to found the corporation off of them, but a lot of times on higher difficulties, the corporations will be gone by then regardless. Now, the shale plant, I actually have less issue with, even though it's a little bit later, just because it's essentially a health bonus empire-wide. You can trade away your coal, and coal is, I think, worth 2 unhealth to your factories or something crazy like that. So you can trade away your coal, still get the benefits of power, and on top of that, you're conferred a 10% production boost. And that's the most typical power plant to build of the three is the coal plants. So the shale plant has some use. The mall...
no use at all.
It's a little late to be used. Once you get it, it's really nice, but it's late.
It's the same thing with
the research institute.
Just say that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great idea for a building, but it's just a little too late.
Yeah, which is the replacement for the laboratory, and the Fatoria is the replacement for the custom house, and then the assembly plant, the German replacement for the factory. We might as well, if we're going to rip unique buildings, we might as well rip the civs, too, that they are unfortunately attached to. Well, not really rip the civ, but, you know, we feel sorry for you. Fatoria, unique building for Portugal, and the Research Institute, the unique building for the Russians, and, of course, the mall. Well, if I have to tell you what that replaces, then maybe you shouldn't be listening to this podcast.
I just want to speak up in defense of the assembly plant. I mean, I don't think it's that bad. I don't know, maybe I just dislike shale plants so much just because I usually don't build coal plants. That might be my least favorite, but if any unique building were to be close to that in terms of how much I dislike it, it's probably a shale plant.
What does it give you over the basic building?
Well, if you're going for a space factory, like, it makes it a little bit easier to get the great engineer.
Generally don't want to be running engineers in a city that's dedicated to hammers, though, I mean, unless you're Pop 20 or something. But that's not usually realistic in cities dedicated to hammers. They don't seem to have that kind of draw. I mean, I guess you could use it in your great person farm city to farm out some engineers if you couldn't get them with just your ironworks and the engineer slots already afforded to you by a normal factory, I guess. Having that many engineer slots just doesn't usually become practical. If you're going to be running a corporation like Mining Inc., you want to get that out as soon as you can. A lot of the space racers I talk to in Hall of Fame actually go for Mining Inc. before they even get to an assembly line. So that would be a major thorn in their side to have to wait that long for it.
The difference between a factory and assembly line is an assembly line you can build 50% faster with coal, and you can turn 4 citizens into an engineer as compared to 2.
Yeah. Those benefits, considering how late they are, they're just not that valuable over the base building, especially if you don't have coal. One of the leaders who uses it is even organized, so the actual benefit isn't that great.
So would there be any way to make a late unique building interesting or something worth building? Because we've mentioned a lot of the late ones and most of the polling in the discussion, except for the Dun, which, I mean, I think, depending on the map, the Dun can be very, very useful or very, very useless. It really does depend on your terrain. But is there any way to make a late unique building interesting or viable?
Not make it late. Oh, I'm sorry, you want to construct it inside.
Maybe increase the bonuses? Their effects, but then that's going to mess with game balance too much, maybe.
Yeah, you'd have to make them powerful, but then it would really screw with the game balance, too.
Right.
It'd be the one only solution in the late game.
With the assembly plant, rather than turn 4 citizens into engineers based on strict number of hammers that the engineers give you, maybe make it a percentage base of your existing hammer production, you get that much more. But you wouldn't want it to be too high, because then you have a game balance issue that people have already mentioned.
Well, right, especially if you're going for a space race victory, you don't want to have too much of a production bonus attached to a factory like that.
I don't necessarily buy this balance argument. You have all these civs who have extremely powerful early unique units, or in some rare cases unique buildings, or in one case both, with excellent trait distributions, and you're telling me that stronger bonus that comes later that can be planned against is going to be breaking game balance? Even something as seemingly overly ridiculous like a 3-move tank, there are answers for it, especially if you're at tech parity with them. Compared to, like, a Praetorian, which you can counter hammer for hammer with axes, but not easily, not with a local concentration of troops. these early benefits need to be smaller than late game benefits by a significant margin because the snowball effect in Civ. I'm not scared if a resource institute gave a bunch of extra scientists or something. By then, very frequently the game is in hand. If you're going to have a unique that late, it should be good enough to overcome some difficult situations. And in that case, it's going to seem really strong relative to the early stuff. But it should seem really strong relative to the early stuff.
Well, that's just it, though. The early unique buildings and units and stuff like that seem powerful because of the snowball effect. I don't think on their own they're more powerful than the late game. It's just by the late game you're pretty well set in stone in your path, and to alter that would take a really strong unique building or unique unit.
That's not true, actually. Especially in the unit side, the earlier benefits are actually stronger.
Picking an early mid one that I don't like is kind of tough because there are so many edge cases.
Yeah, you can have a field day with some of those later game ones. Oh, I don't know. How about the Salon, the French one?
I actually don't dislike the Salon that much. It comes on like around mid-game, like astronomy, and if you're the type to get astronomy early, then it provides a nice boost. I'm okay with it.
Be looking at cities to be building observatories anyway, but just plus one free artist, that's the difference over the base.
Not very good unless you're in representation.
Original poster eliminated some for being awesome. So why is the Say one in this poll? It's just a university with 10 extra percent. How is that bad?
Didn't get any votes. I think his logic was he could only include so many options in the poll, so he just picked, like, his whatever best and included absolutely everything else. I feel like the Trading Post, the Seowon, the Mint, those things really have no place even being considered here, or, like, even the Garden.
Yeah, who are the five people that voted for the Trading Post?
I don't know. I guess if you only play Great Plains or something, then the Trading Post is going to suck, but for most normal maps, like Fractal Continents, Hemispheres, anything but Pangaea, your Trading Post is pretty useful.
How about the Mint? I like the Mint.
Oh, I forgot. That's two cities with a really good unique building and unit then, because I felt Inca was also. Forgot about the Mahali.
So for those listening, furiously trying to go to their browsers and look up what these unique buildings are, Trading Post replacing the Lighthouse for the Vikings, free Navigation 1 promotion for naval units and plus 1 on water tiles. The Mint, Malinese Forge replacement, giving you plus 10% gold production over the base. What else did people vote for on this list? Totem Pole as the worst? Come on, that can be obnoxious.
In the right hands, it's a pain in the ass.
Come on, Protectus?
Yeah.
If we look on the list, we've already talked about the Dunn at 39 for the worst. The Mall 18, we've already talked about. Oh, and the Research Institute is tied with it. And then comes the Stele, the Ethiopia.
No idea.
Stele? I don't know.
Stele.
First off, what is it? Because I don't play.
Stella!
That's a monument replacement from Ethiopia. And it looks like the difference is, plus 25% culture.
Okay, that's not bad, actually, for something that early.
A lot of people say that they won't build it because he's creative anyway and they don't need the border pop. These people usually are the kind that just instantly destroy everybody next to them because a rush is actually viable. When you actually have to fight over your culture tiles, that thing can come in handy.
Another strong creative civ, the good defensive unit.
Yeah. Oh, Ormos, no. They're good at everything, not just defense.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're good defensively also.
Then it was the Salon, which we've already talked about, and then comes the Assembly Plant, which we've also talked about. We just talked about the Totem Pole, and then tied for at 6 votes. There's the Obelisk, the Egypt monument replacement.
Allows you to run 2 priests.
Could have some usefulness.
It opens up some abuses. If you have a religion to shrine, you can shrine it easily, so that's nice. But the biggest abuse is that you can bowl theology really early and get an easy crack at the Apostolic Palace. If you get that tech first, found the religion, and build the AP in it, you win, if you want to win diplomatically. It's nice for the hammers, too, so net trade's all right. So it's decent for that.
What else was 6? The Shale Plant, which we've already talked about, okay. We talked about the Trading Post, and what else was tied with 5? The Fitoria, Portugal, which we know we also talked about. The Citadel, Spain, has 4 votes for worst unique building.
Huh?
I guess people don't like it because it's a castle.
Oh.
Although it's just incredible otherwise.
Yeah, you want to get those siege bonuses.
City Raider 3 siege out of the gate from, like, a typical city, that's just... And people don't realize that if you avoid certain technologies, you can keep doing that. You can build the City Raider 3 artillery out of the gate. You just have to avoid Economics Corporation, but you can still get rifles, you can still get machine guns, And you can run around with City Raider 3 artillery. That's pretty crazy.
3 votes, India's Mausoleum.
It's a happy jail. I don't have to say about it. It's mid-game, so it's not great, but it's not bad either. +2 happiness.
2 people voted for the Khmer's Beret. The Aqueduct Replacement. +1 food in addition to the +2 health.
Yeah.
Wow. Also at 2 votes is Mongolia's Stable Replacement. +4 experience for mounted units. How could you vote that as the worst? I'm disappointed. I suppose unless you have absolutely no horse and you're bitter, then you might vote for it. But
or if they're just absolute peacemongers who never go to war anyway, then Mongolia's not going to seem very appealing to them either.
Such people exist?
Oh, yeah. I heard about it.
Oh, okay. I guess I used to be one of them. Let's see what else is tied it to. Did we talk about the Madrasa already?
No.
Library replacement. 2 citizens into priests? Is that what the difference is?
Yeah, it opens up 2 priest slots, but it's also 4 base culture instead of 2. And if you build it early and it doubles an 8th then, of course, rather than just 4. So it can be really annoying on the borders.
Okay, we already talked about the pavilion. Let's see, what else is on the list they haven't talked about? The apothecary from Persia?
Just health. It's actually not that great, but it's not horrible either. I think it would have had more votes if it wasn't for Persia. Because the leaders for Persia are so good and so they're in the unit that it kind of gets overlooked. It's sort of like the Forum in that regard, but it is a little better than the Forum.
And then the Garden, Babylon's Garden, Colosseum replacement that gives you +2 health. So there's another health one. How many people voted for that? 1 person.
Yeah, but it's none too shabby.
I think we've talked about them all, haven't we?
All of them that got votes, I think. Well, we even talked about the Seiwan, which didn't. So the only thing we didn't mention was, what, the Kothan? As a trade route, as a harbor replacement for Carthage. I can understand why that didn't get votes. It's good building. Costs a little extra, but for a trade route, it's usually worth it. Unless you're isolated or something. And even then, it'll eventually help you out.
And so the ones that Phi Calais, who started this thread, excluded, Iaconda, Ratha, Sacrificial Altar, Dyke, Hammam, Balcourt, Ziggurat, Terrace, and Stock Exchange. The only one I'm not immediately familiar with, and I'm going to have to look up, is the Ottoman one.
It's +2 happiness on aqueducts. And it deserves its placement there. I'm a little annoyed that the dyke made his can't vote for this list. Although I wouldn't vote it for worst, I suppose. Oh, it's painfully overrated. I know I've said that on the show before, but it is. Considering how late it is, similar to a lot of the other late unique buildings, and the fact that you don't want to be working water tiles normally, even if they're worth a hammer, it's like working at forest with some extra commerce. You don't want to work that before your land tiles. But okay, it helps on water maps. Most of the other stuff that he discluded is really the top-notch unique buildings that are awesome.
Well, we last discussed unique buildings in episode 62, which was the last season, where we actually talked about the best of them, and I actually had a top 10 there. I do not have a top 10 this time. Nobody faint. I hope everybody's sitting down. Most of those that he, on his exclusion list, were also in the top 10. So if you want to know what those top 10 were, you're going to have to go listen to episode 62. And if you listen to it once, then listen to it again. If you have to download it a few more times and stats go up, then please do. You know, I don't mind. Tell a friend.
Oh, Dan, you're such a kidder. Like, we would really try to hold out extra views using this show. No, no way. Settling in place. When not to. Thread started by Dreadful here. He said he's browsed the forums and he wants some general rule of thumb concerning settling in place. He said he always settles in place, and when he said he did move his settler, it didn't help him sometimes, or the times where it did was very rare. So he's asking when it's a good idea to not settle in place. And that's a bit of a tricky situation. Usually, you're better off settling in place unless you see a really good reason not to with your starting unit, either scout or warrior. And you try to move your warrior to optimally to see if there is potential for that. Very frequently, I'll move my scout one way to see what kind of tiles I'm losing out, and then if I have another resource that was in view the other direction, I might move for it. Moving onto a Plains Hill tile, which gives you a suit 2 hammer city tile, could be useful. Same thing with, say, Plains Ivory, or especially the Marble Hills or Stone Hills, which are worth 3 hammers on your city tile. Those can merit moving. Otherwise, you might move to pick up a food resource you wouldn't have otherwise. Maybe to get coastal if you're playing a map script where you know that Great Lighthouse is going to be a big deal. So it's a bit of a situational thing, and you really have to know what you're doing. I wouldn't be as presumptuous as Dave MCW here and said that it's an advanced strategy for only Emperor or above. But at the same time, you do have to have some ability to read the map and some idea of strategy in general for this game at a reasonable high level before you can really tell the difference between whether it's beneficial to settle in place or to move. I would say most of the time, at least well over half the time, it's usually better to settle in place.
Particularly if the move is going to cost you a turn, say, on Prince or higher?
Yes, although you have to be careful with that, because if you move onto a plane tiller or something, you get your worker out one turn sooner or several turns sooner. I think it's usually three, actually. That can be worth it then, because you have an extra turn of working on an unimproved tile if you settle in place, while you have like two or three extra turns of working the improved tile if you don't. So you can actually come out ahead by moving, even if it costs you a turn, potentially. But then you still have to evaluate what you're going to do with your resources, which is really fun on a blazing turn timer, I must say. That's good times.
On most situations, not moving is the thing to do. Playing mostly multiplayer games myself, we've made an art form out of creating equal start map and the like. You generally won't see people moving without a real strategic reason, like to move towards water to get a port city.
Or if you're running something like Mirror, you kind of know in a teamer. Somebody posted the code for starts recently, and the game has a very questionable method evaluating what constitutes a good start versus not. There's just no rule of thumb there. I mean, you just have to look and decide, unfortunately.
We could say there's a rule of thumb and get some controversy.
Okay, the rule of thumb is to settle in place, and then if you see something else, don't. That's pretty broad, but that's your rule of thumb. There you go.
Now, in the poll, the choices are yes, really cool, more brainstorming. No, takes the rawness war out of it. Yes, you have my ear, and no, but it's not the worst idea.
Okay, it's not the worst idea I've ever heard.
Is he actually saying rawness? Are we missing an S on the end there? I think so.
I don't think so. I think he really meant rawness, although I've not seen it used in that context.
Unless it's missing an S, then it's just NES.
NES is a great system, I'll have you know.
I actually think I was too young. No, actually, I wasn't too young. I don't know. What is NES?
Okay, you are too young.
Yeah, you're young.
You answered that question. Yeah.
I've seen pictures.
Ancient history.
In a museum.
This is Forum Talk, where we investigate hot Civ issues in the forums.
Zero-day downloadable content disrespecting the customer.
This should be good for some conversation.
Yeah. Ramp up the controversy again.
Exactly. This thread, started by Fungus420, says, I've come to the conclusion that the zero-day downloadable content, as announced, amounts to disrespect and contempt by the company towards Civ fans, quote-unquote. And as we find out later, he's referring to Civ developer Firaxis Games. Continuing, he says, having a zero-day DLC that provides a special gun or an armor or something is pretty normal and well-accepted, but this is not what Firaxis is doing here with Babylon. Typical zero-day DLC is designed and marketed towards hardcore fans and usually provides some type of minor cheating or aesthetic consideration, like the collector gun or dragon armor in Mass Effect. It makes no effect on the actual gameplay, storyline, or core game. Quote-unquote. Just going to back up a bit for our listeners to what are we talking about. And it appears that he is referring to those who acquire the deluxe edition of Civilization V, which is to include Babylonian Civilization as Civilization number 19. There is also, however, those who order Civ V from Steam to receive the downloadable bonus content, Cradle of Civilization Map Pack Mesopotamia. I guess I'll continue reading his post and then have some definition issues here. What Firaxis is doing with Babylon is investing the time and energy to create a full new Civ and then intentionally removing it from the base game merely as a way to build customers that already intend on purchasing the main product. This is just downright disrespectful. The whole Steam thing, I can understand. I personally don't like it, but it's sound business. Digital rights management has to be implemented, and Steam is known for being unobtrusive and is quite popular amongst most gamers. What I do not understand or agree with on any level is intentionally removing core game content in an effort to squeeze loyal fans for more dollars. As I said, it's just plain disrespectful and shallow. So Firaxis, I wag my finger at thee, unquote. And it also includes a smiley right afterwards that does just that. Let's be clear on a couple of things before I get to the downloadable content issue. A lot of this, and it didn't come up in the first handful of pages in this 14-page thread as of this recording, so maybe it did come up a little later, that this is a decision not by Firaxis Games, CIF, or developer, but the publisher 2K Games. So if you want to direct concern in this regard, whether it be constructive concern or not, as some people engage in, then you want to direct it at 2K. But he's talking about Babylon as DLC, but this is Babylon that is coming part of the deluxe edition, which do not have to purchase from Steam. So what it is it's $10 more for Babylon, but not just Babylon, for, I think, Cradle of Civilization map pack, and then as well as the video. So besides those definitions, my position as far as Babylon is that it's not part of the core gameplay. It's something extra. If it's something that you're interested in and getting right from the outset, then you can purchase that. If you don't like that, it's not that you're going to be denied Babylon. It's, as some people pointed out, no doubt someone will mod a Babylonian civilization. So if you really want a Babylonian civilization, just wait a little bit and you'll have it anyway.
My only question is how it affects multiplayer balance. Is there any inherent advantage to doing so? Because really there wouldn't be for most Civ 4 Civs. And I guess if someone could use Rome and you couldn't, but even there, you could usually deal with that, so I don't know.
This really bothers me as a both consumer and as a gamer. I say that one civilization isn't a core gameplay, but this really is not the same as selling, you know, special units in a collector's unit of a Total War game where you get different uniforms, but they're still rifles with different names. This is an entire civilization you'll have to pay $10 extra for. And yeah, you get the extra video and the making of stuff and a map or a tech tree. That's all traditional collector's edition stuff. But a new civilization, a civilization that has always been a part of the civilization experience. It was one of the very first civilization. Nebuchadnezzar, finally we're seeing him instead of Hammurabi, yay Nebuchadnezzar. I think this is pushing collector's content too far. This is a new experience that is not going to be available to gamers to begin with. Relying on the mod community is a cop-out. That's okay, the community will give you what the developers have traditionally given you, but won't now. You have to pay for it. Who knows if they'll even allow a Babylonian mod somehow, so they have their own clearinghouse, their own activating system for mods within Civ 5, which is great. It won't be the same Babylon. There will be 5 or 6 competing Babylonian mods for the first year. Eventually, it'll be sold as separate DLC and as an expansion pack. But I think this is wrong. I think it is wrong to have a civilization you have to pay extra for, especially one that's central and core. So many Civ players want that extra civilization. They will pay the extra money for it. You can say, well, okay, then you're buying it and you're making a choice. And I will make that choice. I'm stupid and I'm an idiot and I love civilization, so I'm going to make the choice. But I'm not going to like it. And I think this is a bad pattern, and it's going to continue if it's a success. And the next expansion pack will be collector's edition of that. Only now, if you want the Polynesians, you have to pay an extra $10. This is not the same as Civ 4, where it's a bunch of different traits and it's mix and match. A lot of energy is being put into this, and I think every civilization player should have a chance to see every civilization based on if they want to play this game, not if they have $10 extra to spend. I think it's wrong.
Problem is, they can get away with it, and they probably will in your case, too, since you're saying you're going to buy it.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the unfortunate reality of it. As much as you don't like it,
yeah,
they're trying to make money, and if they can...
I'm not saying it's a bad business decision. I'm not saying I'm a strong man, by any means. I'm certainly weak in many ways. But it doesn't mean I like it. It doesn't mean I think it's ethical. It's a great business decision. They're going to make a ton of money off of it. But there are tons of ways gaming companies are making money off of us in selling DLC. How much did Bethesda make off of Horse Armor and Oblivion? Something completely useless, and they sold tons of it because we're all idiots. I just don't like where this is going.
Well, I think philosophically speaking, the difference between selling downloadable content on day one and selling an XP a year later, it's the same deal. Except that now, on an XP, everyone moves to the expansion pack pretty much. Everyone bought Warlords, everyone bought Beyond Sword. Now you're getting, on day one of the game being released, two different versions. And presumably, it's likely going to be in the same lobby, playing against the same people. So to me, the problem isn't that we're paying for a 19th Civ. Because unlike some people who are posting that they think, oh, they're ripping a Civ out of the base game. Well, the base game comes with 18 Civs. That's all that a sieve vanilla has ever had, is 18 sieves. So for your money, you're getting your 18 sieves. And if you want to pay $10 extra, you're getting a 19 sieve. And you're right. A sieve is not a piece of armor or a nice-looking eye candy. It's core gameplay. When you have, especially in multiplayer, an 8-person free-for-all, and only 2 people can get Babylon out of a random sieve pick there, that's a problem.
And if the other DLC are other civilizations, if they're all releases, is this just a multiplied problem?
Yes, it's going to snowball. And yes, eventually, probably in the first expansion pack, and I imagine there still will be expansion packs, they'll roll the previous DLC into it and sell it for whatever they can rip out of our pockets. Mm-hmm. To me, it's not so much of a moral issue with selling us stuff. It's a mechanics issue with multiplayer and, of course, with mods. Can our modders friggin' make a Babylon sieve? Even if they use no code and no art from 2K. There wouldn't be any specific legal action, probably, but is 2K going to host those mods on their community hub? I would think probably not. So that's another issue, and if I was a modder, I'd be really concerned about this.
I agree.
Speaking, because I'm primarily a multiplayer, that if there isn't in some sort of in-game checkbox you can use to disable DLC, we're just going to have to make our own community rules to do the same thing, to make it a fair sandbox again. We won't have any choice, otherwise there's no conflict in the MP sandbox as it is without creating war because you can have Babylon and I can't.
One could argue that such disparities between like people who have certain aspects of the game who don't have existed in some form or another with the practice of selling expansion packs. I think the primary difference here is that parity is more graded, and as was said before, that these different versions will be coming out on the same day.
I forget who posted it in the thread, and I alluded it to before in terms of what do you get with your Civilization V editions. And strictly speaking, looking at the Babylonian Civilization, the standard edition, whether you pre-order it or you just order it after release, you don't get it. It's only in the deluxe edition, pre-order or not pre-ordered. When it comes to the Fertile Crescent map, which is the cradle of civilization, which is the part of this we haven't really talked about yet, in the standard edition, pre-order, and in the deluxe edition, it's free. But if you don't pre-order the standard or the deluxe edition, then it's looking like it's not going to be free, and then that's something that you can get afterwards for X amount of dollars. Firaxis and 2K have already set precedent with downloadable content in the console world of Civ with Civilization Revolution, where some actually was free in the case of there is a single map pack called Brave New Worlds released in late 2008. And at the same time, they also released the Victory Pack Scenario Pack, which was $1.25 American on the PlayStation Network. And then with Xbox Live, you buy so many Microsoft points, and it was 100 MS points. I assume that's like the equivalent to $1.25 US.
Yeah, I have no doubt that after 2K and Steam have figured they've gotten all the pre-sales they're going to get out of this, soon after release, you'll be able to download the DLC on Ildabaoth in the map pack for X dollars, whether it be $2 or $5 or whatever. They'll probably make it available to the consumer at some minor cost and try and squeeze a few more dollars out of this.
Or they'll put it out for free a few weeks later, like BioWare did with some of the Mass Effect stuff. The first few DLCs they put out were actually free. They may wait a month or two after the game comes out, and then Babylon may be free for download.
Gears of War did that with its map packs, but I just didn't buy them until they became free then.
Some people are making the argument that, of course, DLC downloadable content, this is going to be just like with Civ, like it is with a number of gaming franchises. Now, this is the new order in terms of expansion packs, rather than having a whole bunch of things packaged together a little later after release. You'll have, even on the day of release, and then interspersed at times, smaller components that you would otherwise see in an expansion pack. And some people argue that this is good because, oh, I would really like to get, for instance, this extra civilization, but it includes all of this other stuff too, and it costs $10. Babylon is just strictly downloadable content. Maybe it'll just be $1 or $2, and then that way you can pick and choose what you want. I can see that argument well, but I think it is the snowball effect, and I understand some people are concerned that if this is where it starts, where does it end, especially when you look at other gaming titles in terms of how they do their downloadable content, both in terms of what that downloadable content is and the timing. Companies trying to make more money, Well, I understand that, and I think that just in terms of how they deliver that downloadable content, if they alienate the community too much in terms of how they're doing this, then in the end, they may find themselves losing money, because as much as people would like to play the game in terms of how they can acquire the game legally, it's just going to be too much of a pain. So I think it has potential benefits for both the user and the company. But in terms of not only how they do it, but also in terms of how they market it, just need to be careful so it's not one step forward, two steps back in terms of getting the content that people want and maybe only the content that they want. Like, I want to just pay for Babylon. I don't care about your video about how you made it. I don't want to have to pay $10. Just give me Babylon for free. In addition to that, the mechanics item that was mentioned, such as in multiplayer, so that people are informed in terms of setting up a match, for instance, okay, who has the ability to play Babylon? I don't have the ability to play, but you do. Do we want then to allow you to be able to play Babylon even though that I can't? Or do we want to say that you can play, but we're just going to disable your ability to play Babylon or whatever the unique is? Depending on how it was implemented, there's also some interface questions as well in terms of how complicated that would be. Was that something you'd be able to see at a glance in a lobby, or would you have to strike up a conversation with someone to find out? So what version of Civ 5 do you have today?
Yes, compatibility becomes a big question mark here that hasn't really been clarified. Especially when you get to the point where you maybe have two or three DLCs later in the year, they come up with an expansion pack. Traditionally, expansion packs means total incompatibility. You can't play the previous game, but how is it going to work with Civ 5? The next pack is a large DLC, really? Or is it going to be like a traditional X pack? It could be a mess.
Expansion packs are different because they often add major gameplay changes. They're not just new content. One reason why there's all this incompatibility. But yeah, I mean, the question is, how are different versions of Civ going to play with each other? And what do the players think is important?
I have another concern. Yeah, I don't think we've hashed on it yet, but it could be equally bad. And that's the quality and balance of each of these DLCs that comes out.
Mm-hmm.
Just to say some examples from Civ 4, the code for the United Nations resolutions and Apostolic Palace resolutions, mechanics behind capitulation and peaceful vassaling, they're god-awful. I don't know how they made a final game. That's the kind of stuff that you would be a little painful to see in beta. The AI will pick a UN resolution, fits the chair, rolls a dice. It doesn't have any strategic basis for doing that. So if our DLC is going to see a lot of features added that are like that, then it could be a problem. And then the other thing is, when you have piecemeal additions of mechanics, say you added a Rome with a 12-strength Praetorian or something, that could potentially happen if you're releasing things every now and then, or something that just completely destroys the current metagame to the extent where, you know, it just breaks the game. And when you're adding features piecemeal, that's much more likely to happen than it would be if you were to test out an entire new patch, an entire new set of DLC or whatever. So we have significant balance and then quality issues to address if we're going to be doing, like, just monthly or whatever DLC options.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff is only going to see more frequency when there's less time to test it between when the thing gets made and when it's released.
Not to mention what it does to a community. How big is the Civ community if everyone's playing with a different 20 civilizations?
Yeah, well, there's that too.
They may be able to help themselves out a little bit with some of the balance if it's one of those, well, let's have 10 things that we're going to release as downloadable content just to choose a nice round number. And then decide, okay, we're going to develop all of that simultaneously, but we're going to release it staggered.
It's still dangerous.
Oh, I don't disagree. It doesn't address everything, and that might be something that might be helpful, but until it's actually released, even then, I mean, you have beta testers, but if you're not necessarily going to know what the ultimate effects are going to be, and I'm not saying that's a be-all and end-all solution, but that might be something for them to consider.
Right.
It'll curb it, but again, you're not going to see the potential on those until they're all out. Once you release them one by one, it might have a different effect on gameplay than if you released all 10, too. That kind of stuff is very hard to predict, because even if you have very good beta testers, people at the top of the game, you're not going to have a lot of them, and you're not going to have a lot of time for them to really iron out the worst problems that may arise once it hits the wild, so to speak. And game balance is a tricky thing. It is not easy to do that. That's one of the reasons that the games that manage it are so popular, so famous, and so well acclaimed, is that it's so difficult to get that done correctly. It's like stepping on landmines when you're doing something like this where you're changing the balance reasonable frequency.
There was one comment in this discussion that I disagreed with completely, which was from Arstall, where he's saying, not so much about this is all part of bringing the quote-unquote superior console experience to your PCs. That was the first part of his point. But then he says, too bad not enough people care for a difference to be made. I think just this thread alone demonstrates that there are people who are concerned, and they are voicing that, and they're discussing that. Some with greater effect than others. If you're going to criticize, do so constructively, and hopefully in your constructive criticism you actually are making a reasonable argument. If we are going to say criticize, make it constructive, it's more likely that Firaxis and indeed 2K, who are no doubt making these final decisions, will be listening to what the community is saying. It has already been touched upon, is we're getting some information about downloadable content, but not the whole experience in terms of how it affects this, that, and the other thing. Hopefully, maybe there'll be somebody from 2K, for instance, to clarify some of these points. I think the one point that did get clarified was someone saying, oh, they'll probably charge for patches now.
No.
That was already clarified, I think, on the 2K forums. No, patches would not be, like, charged downloadable content. You could argue that anything that you download is downloadable content. Really, right? The paid version there, let's qualify that. Official paid downloadable content.
Although there's been talk of that in the gaming community recently, and it's been disturbing some people paying for patches. From what I understand, it came up regarding Infinity Ward's Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2, which I play, so I was privy to it. But there's so much cheating in that game. And I don't mean, like, using glitches to, you know, glitch off the map or something. I mean cheating. I mean people who are hacking game files to allow nukes in care package or weapons that are supposed to be, like, semi-automatic, firing full auto and just destroying people. Or, like, people have the ability to see other people through walls because of the hacks. People are saying, well, I would pay to fix this. Well, that's something that really should be being fixed by Infinity Ward, like, now, because it's a major issue. And if that kind of stuff starts getting charged, it's not going to be good for gaming.
I don't think anyone can say that the Civ community doesn't care about the issue. There's pages and pages of threads on Steam and DLC and DRM. Not all of it all that educated and logical, mind you, but it definitely shows that the community is concerned about the issue. We hope 2K at least produces a model that doesn't divide the community anyway. I don't think any of us have anything against 2K making some cash, as long as it's done right.
Yeah, I think that's where the lack of information on how everything's going to fit together, that is my big concern. I do really want to have everyone to be able to play Babylon. I do think this is a major issue. Sharing the experience, because a big part of civilization is the community. But that's not going to happen, so at least they can give us some information about how everything's going to work.
And I think likely, just like so much about Civ 5 right now, we're probably not hearing a whole bunch about some stuff, simply because it either hasn't been designed or the decisions haven't been made yet. So hopefully they will open up more, make decisions, and educate the community, because knowledge is power. And it will make people feel, even if they don't agree with 2K, at least they'll know what the lay of the land is.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at ThePolyCast or email us at ThePolyCast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Podcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
This has been Polycast 95, John Ryder, a.k.a. Connect Soldier, with Dan Quick.
Now that you've listened to this episode, that's one more closer to 100.
Woohoo!
Makula, I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, so I apologize now.
You are, and you're not sorry, but it'll continue.
Yeah, well, I gotta at least pretend I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'll be running and hiding again now, thanks. Bye.
Why did you ever come out of hiding in the first place?
I was lured with the promise of cookies.
There are never cookies.
Lisa Bang.
Goodbye. No cookies.
No.
Philip Bilou.
I will be available for downloadable content next month. Tune in.
And Troy Goodfellow.
Bye, everyone.
Oh. Oh, I don't know. Why am I don't know why I'm arguing against this. I don't even disagree with it.
There is also, however, those who order Civ 5 from Steam to receive the downloadable
It's like stepping on landmines when you're doing something like this where you're changing the balance reasonable frequency.
I played Tokugawa the other day just to see if the shield plant was actually like, yeah, it was okay, but I don't know. I don't like it.
All right, guys. Don't mind our junior co-host here. We're working on her. We're working on her.
Record date?
May 22nd, 2010.
Civilization 4, Warlords and Beyond the Sword sound clips, copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.